watching these women step up and say, screw it, I've got kids. I don't have time for this. I'm going to pass good policy. I'm going to talk about these issues. I'm going to talk about them from a really personal way and talk about how these policies affect me at a visceral level. I love those badass women.
Hello, this is the Great Battlefield Podcast. I'm Nathaniel G. Perlman. A great political battle is being fought right now between progressives and the forces of reaction on the other side. This show is about the political entrepreneurs and other progressive leaders who are finding new or improved ways to fight. My guest today is another political entrepreneur, Luba Gretchen Shirley. She is founder and CEO at Vote Mama, a set of organizations working to break down barriers to mothers engaging in politics, particularly as candidates, as Luba was in her 2018 congressional run, which she undertook with two kids, aged 1 and 3. So, after a quick word from my sponsor, my interview with Luba at Vote Mama.
Check out the large, detailed, and high-quality political data graphic posters from Timeplots. Our visual history of the American presidency, for example, lets you see the Clinton, Bush, Obama, and Trump presidencies in full context. Timeplots library includes visual histories of the United States House, the United States Senate, the Supreme Court, and the Democratic and Republican parties. Find them all at www.timeplots.com. Use the code BATTLEFIELD for a discount.
Luba, would you mind introducing yourself and giving me a quick biography?
Sure. I'm Luba Gretchen Shirley. I'm the founder and CEO of Vote Mama. I am a mom of three. I used to work in women's economic empowerment and international development, and then I ran for Congress when my older two were just 1 and 3. And my experience on that campaign prompted me to launch an organization in the way that moms run and serve.
Yeah, there are so many organizations that are dedicated to advancing candidates of different categories. I don't think I've heard moms before. I've heard women, obviously, things like Emily's List or Emerge, but not specifically moms. Why is that needed?
Why is that needed? Because legislators legislate on their lived experience. And we do not have the experience of enough moms of minor children in particular at all levels of government. I was not planning on running for Congress. I was an angry mom and I decided to step up and run. And everybody immediately looked at me, not as somebody who had an MBA or who had worked all over the world or who had run organizations, but as somebody who was a mom of two toddlers. And that was my entire identity. And people didn't take me seriously at first. And I would get questions like, how could you do this to your children? Who's going to watch your kids while you're campaigning? I wanted to change the perspective because if we ever want to reach gender parity, we need to do something about how difficult it is for moms to run. Only 5.3% of our state legislators are moms of minor children. Only 6.8% of our federal legislators are moms of minor children. And then you look at our policies. We're the only country in the world without paid family leave. We're 27th in education globally. We're 27th in healthcare globally. Childcare is more expensive than college. We're failing children in this country. We have shootings regularly at schools, and we need the perspective of more moms who live these policies every day. If you have people who understand these policies at the table, your legislation changes. The priority completely shifts.
What's the intersection of that impulse and that dedication with partisanship at this time? Because there are moms who support a lot of the things that you just mentioned, improving our standing in the world and improving the lives of the population in the United States. And then there are moms who honestly are on the other side of those fights. How do you contend with that? Not just between the parties, but just ideologically, because there are some moms who wouldn't necessarily be the allies of the direction that you're stating.
Yeah, no, you're completely correct. On our PAC side, we only endorse and fund Democratic moms running from school board to Senate. On our foundation side, we work across the aisle. On our foundation side, we're working to break the structural barriers that hold women back. from running. So we have a lot of bipartisan support, and we work with Republican legislators to get things like campaign funds for childcare passed. We just saw Rep. Ana Paulina Luna. She's only the 12th member of Congress to ever give birth while serving. And now she's trying to get virtual voting implemented because she understands that this makes a difference. She just had her first baby, and she understands that virtual voting and virtual committee hearing participation is important. And she's working across the aisle on that. While there are plenty of Republican moms that I don't agree with on many policies, at the same time, they do bring a different perspective. They bring a perspective of, I'm here for my children, and I will work across the aisle, and I'm more willing to talk about pieces of legislation that really makes a difference to kids across the country. We're not going to agree with everybody. We're going to work to defeat Moms for Liberty candidates across the country. We're doing that now. Having that perspective still makes a difference. One of my favorite stories, Jen McClellan, who's now, she's one of our moms, she's a Congress mama. And when she was a state senator, she had to stand up on the floor and explain how breastfeeding worked to some of her colleagues because they were debating a bill that would give women time to pump. And this is something that Republican women understand as well and will support. But the men on the floor were saying, can't you just breastfeed at certain hours of the day? And why do you need this time? And why does it need to be flexible? And Jen had to stand up and explain how breastfeeding works. And
well, it's good that there was someone there who was willing to do that, but it seems a little late to have to educate a grown man about something like that.
You would think. You know, Allie Phillips is running for a state seat in Tennessee. She's another one of our moms. She's a young mother. She has a six-year-old. She was pregnant with her second child, a daughter, and she was really excited. And she found out horrible news that she did not have a viable pregnancy. She was not able to access an abortion and had to crowdfund her way to New York to get access to an abortion. And by the time she got there, the baby had died in utero. It's a horrible experience that no one should have to go through. But when she came home and went to talk to her state representative, he literally said, well, I'm a man, but I'm confused. You're a mom already? I thought you could only have a miscarriage with your first pregnancy.
It's head exploding. Yeah. Some people have just a sequence of unfortunate events, and it's terrible to have to deal with. So yeah, it's the ignorance. When you can't really overestimate the ignorance that's out there, unfortunately. I want to take the chance to explore your biography a little bit more than we did off the top, because I just think it's interesting to see the route that people take to starting organizations like this. Tell me a little bit about the kind of family you grew up in and your education.
Yeah, I was raised by a single mom. I'm an only child. I was raised with my mom's parents. So my grandparents were both Russian immigrants. My father was also Russian, but I was raised by my mom. And we yelled about politics all the time in my family. We would talk about it regularly. I studied politics and Russian at college. I went to NYU. And then I started working, you know, in international development. I worked for the United Nations Association, the UN Foundation. I worked for International House, Carpathian Foundation. And then it's funny, I always wanted to get a degree in international affairs. And I had watched ambassadors who were the heads of one of the organizations I worked for the longest, not able to run the organization well, you know, excellent diplomats, but didn't have those concrete skills. And I got my MBA, which my mother laughed at because I never wanted to work in corporate America, never have. But I got my MBA, and then I had a baby while I was in grad school. At that time, I was the director of operations for a research institute, and we were at NYU, and we were working with smallholder farmers in Ghana. So I was going back and forth to Ghana regularly, to Abu Dhabi, where we had an office as well. I loved that work. That was my dream job. And then I got pregnant, and I did not have any paid family leave. I could not get any sort of flexible working options, and was finishing my MBA. And I made the horrifying decision to myself, but I quit my job. I quit a job that I loved because I couldn't do it all and without access to paid leave. And I remember thinking, that's it. I'm going to be mommy tracked and my career is over and everything that I worked for. And we were living in the city. My husband and I moved to Long Island because my mom is here and could help with childcare. She was still teaching at the time. I had my daughter during the day, and then I would work in the afternoons when my mom got home. I was consulting. And moving to Long Island, I grew up here, but moving back as an adult during the Trump election was eye-opening. There was a parade in the town over for me where they had a dummy of Hillary Clinton in a cage in the back of a pickup truck. There were Trump that bitch bumper stickers everywhere. And to go from Manhattan to Long Island and to have all of these Trump supporters, I lost it. I decided to start an indivisible group and to hold my representative, who had been in office since I was 12, Peter King, responsible for his atrocious voting record. The goal was not to run for Congress. That came later.
I have talked to so many people who that 2016 election was life-changing and brought them into politics and politicized them. And honestly, we're still in that nightmare that started in 2015 with Trump, and would be really nice if it ended this fall.
Not good.
I have also interviewed a number of people who started indivisible groups or run them around the country. Tell me about starting that. That was a new organization back then. It was, I think, very empowering to a lot of people to get together with like-minded neighbors and to wade into the process. Tell me, like, in some detail about your experience there.
It was therapy for me. In all seriousness, I had reached out to the Democratic Party. Mila was not even two at that point. Nicholas was a brand new baby. He was a couple months old, 5 months old at the time. And I kept reaching out to the Democratic Party.
And by the way, I've had two daughters. I know that it's a busy time when you have small children. It absorbs an enormous amount of emotional energy and physical energy.
Yeah. It does. It's funny. I did all of this with them. I was a county committee member in Manhattan, and I moved back out here and kept trying to get in touch with the Democratic Party, and nobody would call me back. And I remember, like, the 80th time I called or emailed, I finally got an email that said, if you tried to reach us but you haven't heard back, send another email and we'll try to get back. Well, screw this. I started a group. I went online. I found all the indivisible stuff. I started a Facebook group, and it grew to 3,000 members really quickly. And I swear, my therapy, I would be up at the crack of dawn nursing Nicholas, and every morning there was a new executive order that came out. And so I kept writing these action alerts. I would say, this is what we're calling Peter King about today. These are all the background and the talking points. Everybody call, record yourself, put it on Facebook, yada, yada. It was how I dealt with Trump being the president. And then the Muslim ban happened. And I remember I kept calling Peter King's office and asking if we could come in and talk to him. And, you know, no. I organized a protest, reached out to groups across the island, and I said, let's do a protest. We had 400 people show up. But even before this, he finally agreed to meet with me. And they told me to come in at 3 o'clock that afternoon. Our protest was scheduled for 4. I get there. They locked the damn doors of the office and they sent their staff home. And we had all these people protest. We had counter protesters screaming and cursing at us. And we had to walk people back to their cars for safety. And he agreed to meet with me after that. But he told the press he would agree to talk to a leader of a resistance group. Not a constituent, not a mom in his community, but a leader of a resistance group. And that kicked off the rest of it.
I have a friend who I was an undergraduate who lived in Peter King's district also for many years. And I just remember, this is way back before this. He's been in Congress for quite a while. And he used to just post on Facebook all the time why he hated his congressman so much. Tell me a little bit about Peter King as a member of Congress.
Oh, Jesus. He voted to repeal healthcare for 74,000 people in our district. It's interesting because my uncle wrote him a letter when I was a kid. My uncle, who's a veteran, wrote him a letter asking him not to support the Iraq War. No, it was even before that. No, I'm trying to think when he wrote this letter, but he wrote him back a letter calling him a bad American. And my uncle saved this letter. My uncle, who's a veteran, has a letter from Peter King calling him a bad American. And he used to call us slime balls and misfits and every ridiculous name you can think of. He would post it on Facebook. And I remember thinking one day as he was typing on Facebook that it must just be an intern making a mistake. And I called the office and they said, no, that was Peter King and he fully supports it. And I organized a town hall for him and he refused to show up. And I got a 6-foot cardboard cutout of Peter King and I put it on stage and I stood there and answered questions. His voting record was atrocious. He voted to defund Planned Parenthood 17 times. He just did not care. And I remember the first time I had to debate him, he couldn't answer any of the questions. And I was so nervous. I mean, I chewed an entire box of Pepto-Bismol on the way to the line. And I thought I was going to pass out. And he got up there and he didn't care. He didn't care about the issues. He was against a woman's right to choose, even in the cases of rape or incest.
So tell me about the district. Long Island has a Republican history, but it's also like New England has mostly moved to be a Democratic area. It's kind of weird from afar to think, what's going on with that district in terms of party and ideology.
It's not a district issue. It's a Long Island issue, and it's a New York issue. So we don't have a Democratic Party in New York. We have two very corrupt county leaders on Long Island. Our Nassau County Dem chair is also our state Dem chair. And our Suffolk County Dem chair, he actively works against Democrats. They supported Peter King for years. Peter King was in that seat for 28 years and never had any sort of real Democratic opposition. We actually have more registered Democrats in our district. It's that they're not organized and that the Democratic Party is as corrupt as possible. It's all controlled by patronage. If you get a job working for Babylon Town Council, because our county chair is also our Babylon Town supervisor, so he controls all of these local positions with patronage, and then you get a seat on county committee, so you continue to vote for him. But we have no organization. There are a few people who try really hard to organize, but they get smacked down. Every time a good Democrat stands up to run, I got attacked more by the Democratic Party locally than I ever did by the Republicans.
What were they attacking you on?
Everything. They would call me a bad mom regularly. I had a leader of one of the local Dem parties in Suffolk County. My son broke his leg 2 months into my campaign. He broke his femur and he ended up in a body cast. And it was hell. Honestly, it was the most horrible experience of my life. And then a week before I won the primary, he broke his leg again. And he was diagnosed with osteogenesis imperfecta during my campaign.
So he broke his leg because he had a weakness in the bone.
Yeah. Yeah. He has OI, so it's basically brittle bone disease. So he's broken his leg 4 times now.
Oh my goodness.
And we figured this all out during the campaign. I mean, he was one. And I had, I talked about it because I was fighting with my insurance company to cover his 2-night stay in the hospital. My insurance company, I kid you not, said he didn't need to be in the hospital for 2 nights. They literally kept him there. I had to have a screaming fit to actually get him into surgery on the second day that we were there because they were taking their damn sweet time. But my insurance company was fighting with me. And I remember sitting in my campaign office with 3 cell phones, and I had the pediatrician, the surgeon, and the insurance company going back and forth about what codes they had put everything under so we could get it covered. So I talked about it. I was public. I never talked about his diagnosis during my campaign, but I talked about that first break because that's what so many people in this country are going through. Half the people who are in bankruptcy are there because of medical bills, because most people don't have 7 hours a day to argue with your insurance company. And I was called a bad mother. My ability to take care of my children was constantly questioned. I was told that I used them as political props. Do you remember the movie Election with Reese Witherspoon?
From back vaguely, in the- yeah, I did see it.
Like yeah. They used to refer to me as Tracy Flick regularly. Just stupid stuff.
But who were you up against in that primary?
Dwayne Gregory, who had run the previous cycle and lost terribly.
So you would think that perhaps the party might be interested in the profile of a young mother who is accomplished, has an MBA, who has run a indivisible group, has energy behind her sounds. I mean, I don't know you very well. I've talked to you for 18 minutes, but it sounds like it might be worth considering.
If you wanted a Democrat to win that seat, I have no problem talking about it publicly now, but they endorsed a man who the last time he ran raised $380,000 for the entire cycle and lost by 24 points.
So what happened in the primary? You beat him, but
I beat him by like 15 points. I outraised Peter King multiple cycles in a row and overall I outraised him and I won the primary and then came within 6 points of Peter King in the general.
One learns a lot being a first-time candidate for a federal office. Tell me a few of the things that, besides the personal stuff and the party insider stuff, like just what were you learning as a candidate about our politics and how to run?
I learned that you have to raise a hell of a lot of money for anyone to take you seriously. I learned that you work 18-hour days. And I learned that you need to figure out how to juggle your life really, really well while running and that you will be attacked constantly and you just get over it and ignore it all.
You need a thick skin to deal with that.
You need such a thick skin. And I developed a thick skin somehow during the campaign. But honestly, to be able to run for office, you have to really enjoy 2 things to do it well. You have to love talking policy and love talking to voters. And you have to like fundraising. You don't have to love it, but you have to like it. I've talked to candidates who hate one or hate both and just can't continue. I genuinely love talking policy. I am a very big nerd and I really get excited about policy. So I love talking policy with people. I love knocking on doors. I love the town halls. You have to do all that. And at the same time, you have to just continue to raise money like crazy.
Did I glean that you ran twice?
No, I only run once, and then I was planning to run the second time. Uh-huh. But I launched Vote Mama. My kids used to run around and scream Vote Mama all the time because I was planning to run. Everyone's like, well, what do you want to do in the interim? I was like, I'm going to launch a PAC. I'm going to use the last bit of money I have in my campaign account, and I'm going to support Democratic moms. And then Vote Mama started to take off. Hillary Clinton came to our launch event, and she ended up taking a FaceTime call from her grandchildren during her speech. And this went on Colbert. And I remember my mom calling me at midnight screaming, you're on Colbert. And we got applications from moms across the country. And I was pregnant with my third child. And I had this amazing organization that I knew I could do more with than one vote in Congress. And I was pregnant again. And all I could think of was, I don't know how to give birth and run at the same time. It was hard enough to do with two toddlers. But I remember sitting there in my campaign staff, and they said, well, we'll give you 2 weeks from maternity leave. 2 weeks after my second child was born, I was hospitalized with an infection. Like, I could not imagine getting back on the campaign trail. And Vote Mama had picked up so much and had so much momentum that I said I wasn't going to run. He retired. And everybody thought I was going to run again. Everybody thought
You might have had that seat, right?
Might have. I absolutely might have, because he stepped down and there was, you know, kind of,
an open seat is a hell of a lot easier to win.
I know. Yeah. And I let somebody else do it. And I built Vote Mama. And we've now supported over 500 Democratic moms running. We've gotten campaign funds for childcare passed now, and 30 states have approved it. We're working to change legislation and to change the way that moms run. And that can do so much more than I could have with one vote.
Did Hillary help you raise any money?
She came to our first event. So yeah, that definitely helped us raise money with that first event.
Tell me about what it took to start the organization and get it off the ground. I'm very interested in the political entrepreneurship that is involved. It is not easy to create something from nothing.
Yeah, it's, God, I don't know. It took sheer determination. It was honestly, it's the same way you run a campaign. When you're not a political insider and you're a new candidate, you run a campaign with sheer determination and little sleep and just constant fundraising. And you have to really want it. And when I launched Vote Mama, I mean, this is my baby. This is my personal mission. So there was no way I was going to take no for an answer. And I immediately started raising money from all of my campaign donors and then continued to grow out this organization. We just hired our 13th staff member. And I can't tell you how exciting it is to have this staff. We just released our latest report yesterday on campaign funds for childcare and the usage. I don't even think I mentioned this, but during my campaign, I got the Federal Election Commission to approve the use of campaign funds for childcare. I put this request
in. I saw that at the time, and that got national news itself, right?
Yeah, it was literally written in every press outlet, and it changed the way that parents run for office. It changed the way caregivers run. 25 members of Congress wrote in support. Hillary Clinton wrote in support, and it was a bipartisan, unanimous decision. And so now that has approved it for all federal candidates, but Vote Mama has now been working to get this approved for state and local candidates. And unfortunately, you actually have to go state by state to get this approved. But I was told it was political suicide. And our report that just came out yesterday has now shown that at the federal level, there has been a 662% increase in usage. And at the state level, a 2,156% increase in usage. It makes a huge difference in who gets to step up and run. But I digress. You asked me about starting the organization.
Yeah.
You know, I called my attorneys that I had during the campaign. We got everything set up and I just started having fundraisers. The first year was very similar to running for Congress. I raised money the way I did for Congress. It's different now. The second year, I gave birth on the same day that I was literally, I remember being in the hospital on a yoga ball editing this article that came out in Time about that I wrote about the foundation. And it was just as we were going into lockdown. I had Andrew in April of 2020. So it was the very beginning of lockdown. And I remember thinking, I have no idea how to raise money in lockdown. And at that point, we had two staff members, then we grew to three pretty quickly, and we started doing Zoom fundraisers. And we've endorsed so many moms. I mean, at the first, it was just the PAC. I didn't launch the foundation until a year later. But we had been doing this work on structural issues and really thought we can do this better from a lobby and from a foundation. So we started the C3 and the C4. This is going to make me sound ridiculous, but I remember I had to fill out like an 80-page response to the IRS about how to track everything and how we're doing this with the C3 and the C4 and our PAC separately. And I dozed off nursing Andrew. And I remember like jerking back and being like, oh my God, how was that last few minutes of my time just spent? Was it spent C3, C4, or PAC?
What? You're wearing a lot of hats these days.
Yeah, it was fun though, but it was sheer determination, and it was hiring people that love politics and are just as big a dorks as I am, that when you have a team like that and you have people who care and who would do this work for free because it's their passion, it's kind of amazing to actually have a team that this is a real organization that we can do this with.
Do you try to hire moms?
So it's funny. We actually just hired the first man on our team. We have now on our team 4 mothers. So we have plenty of people who aren't moms.
What's the scale of this at this point? So I got a sense of your staff, but how much money are you raising that you're able to put out through the PAC to candidates?
Yeah, we're raising millions of dollars across all 3 entities. We put about a couple hundred thousand into the PAC and directly into candidates each year.
What would you like it to turn into? Is this where you want to be, or you have a kind of a growth mindset about this, or?
Well, we have a 3-year strategic growth plan. Pivotal has just invested in Vote Mama, Melinda Gates' company. So we were able to staff up and continue to expand our work, which is just amazing. And we have some really great support from institutional funders and from individual funders as well that are allowing us to expand. So we're now taking this past the Campaign Funds for Child Care work to state-led modernization overall, looking at passing things like virtual voting, virtual committee hearings, paid family leave for state legislators, having things like on-site childcare. You know, there's only one state that has approved paid family leave for state legislators, and it's Colorado. And it's Brittany Pederson, who is one of our moms, who was a state senator when she got it passed, and now she's in Congress. But you can technically take the time off, but you aren't able to vote, you aren't able to participate, you then put yourself at risk for losing your election. And I can't tell you how many state legislators I've spoken with who really want to have a baby or want to have a second baby and are postponing it until they're, you know, not in session and trying to figure out how to do this, but then they might be too old. And this is something that state legislators are constantly juggling. The other problem is state legislators aren't paid a livable wage. There are only 4 states where they're paid a livable wage. In most of those places, childcare costs more than a state legislative salary. So we have so many state legislators who have stepped down, even though they're serving and doing a really great job, because they can't afford to make ends meet and support their family. So we want to take it a step further even and eventually start working on salaries for state legislators to make it full-time legislatures, livable wages, make it an actual job that people can do who are not independently wealthy.
How do you decide which moms you're going to support?
The endorsement process is so much fun. So all of our moms are pro-choice. They all support paid family leave. We have a whole list of policies that they have to support. We interview hundreds of candidates. And on the PAC side, you support the moms. You can tell within the first 3 seconds of talking to someone, maybe not 3 seconds, but you know, a couple of minutes of talking to somebody about whether or not we want to endorse. The people who are so passionate about running that they're running for a particular reason. The people who are willing to do the work, you know, it sucks to raise money, but you need to if you're going to win a campaign. So the people who are willing to put the work in to raise the money and to actually run a successful campaign. This year in particular, our goal is to endorse 200 candidates. At the state level, we're targeting Arizona, Georgia, and Michigan in particular for our top tier candidates. We want to try to get full slates of all the Democratic moms that are running in those states. And then we have many other states that we'll be endorsing from as well. But those are the top 3. And we really love to support school board candidates. You know, we have school board candidates this last cycle who have beaten Moms for Liberty candidates in a number of states. And we had a 79% general win rate this last cycle. It was the highest win rate we've ever had. And I was thrilled with that one. And 65% of our candidates last cycle were non-incumbents. So that's also exciting. The people who are new, who need the help, who need the support, who are excited and who are going to do the work.
Yeah. Do you worry about whether they're in a primary against an incumbent, or the nature of the district, or like how much do you evaluate their electoral viability?
We have a rule that we don't support a Democratic mom if they're running against another Democratic mom in the primary. If they're running against a man or somebody who isn't a mom, we will get involved in primaries. We've definitely got involved in primaries. We just don't want to pit one Democratic mom against another. We, of course, look at the viability of the actual campaign. But frankly, there's also a lot to be said for sometimes it takes numerous campaigns to actually win a seat, and you need to build the groundwork. You know, when I ran in 2018, no one thought that seat was winnable. And it was because the Democratic Party had ignored it for so long. But we proved that it was winnable. The D-Trip swooped in the next year and tried to win the seat and were unsuccessful. But the point is that sometimes in many of these seats, if you support a good candidate, even if that candidate isn't going to win, but they're going to build the ground game and they're going to prove that that seat is viable, it might be won the next year. So we don't always just endorse because we think they're going to win. We think they're going to do something good in the district.
How have the other organizations in the progressive ecosystem responded to your entrance into it? Sometimes groups that exist, that there might be some overlap, might not be ready for another player, you competing for the same funds. Have you found it to be collaborative, or you're out on your own, or are you getting any elbows?
I mean, I think it's a little of both. The funding, the problem, honestly, with all women's organizations is there aren't enough funders supporting the work. We all work together. We're all actually very collaborative, but it's the common thread that you'll hear is there aren't enough funders. There aren't enough funders who are funding at certain levels to be able to do this work sustainably. We have a very specific niche, especially on the work that we're doing on more of our C3 and C4 side. There are organizations like Arena that are training staffers, or Vote Run Lead, who are training candidates. We're working to break the structural issues that hold moms back. There are very few organizations that do that. We don't have that crossover as much, so there isn't as much competition, but we work really closely with so many of the other organizations. We work with Vote Run Lead. We work with Represent Women, Center for American Women in Progress. Like, all of these organizations we work closely with. And then on the PAC side, Higher Heights is one of our partners, and other organizations that have endorsed candidates, Run for Something will constantly send us moms that they're supporting.
That's great.
And we do the same. There is that collaboration.
I recently heard from Erin at Vote Run Lead that she got also some pivotal venture funding. Have you heard that Melinda's money is going into women's organizations generally like that? It sounds like it.
Pivotal and Melinda Gates have been just so supportive. Melinda, actually, I remember the first time she made a personal contribution on the PAC side. It was very exciting. But Pivotal has been really investing in trying to change the ecosystem of politics. They've invested in Vote Run Lead. They've invested in Vote Mama. There are other organizations that they're working with because they know that if we actually want to change politics, that they have to put political dollars in. And these are the kind of organizations they need to focus on. Pivotal has been incredibly supportive and helpful and really making connections to other organizations. And I love the work that they do. I'm a huge fan.
It sounds like it was that 2016 race that pulled you into this. How are you feeling about politics in this country right now? How does that affect what you do at Vote Mama?
I'm terrified, honestly. I was actually at a Roe event two nights ago with President Biden and Vice President Harris. And I was talking to one of our board members and she's like, you have to stay positive. I'm like, I'm not sure I can stay positive. I'm terrified. I'm trying to stay positive. But, you know, I was always involved politically before. But 2016 was when I needed to run. I had always supported candidates. Used to make my husband come stand at subway stops and hand out flyers for candidates all the time at 5 o'clock in the morning. So I was always involved politically. I was very involved in county committee in the city, but I ran because I couldn't sit back and watch anymore. And now I'm terrified of what will happen with this presidential. I'm worried what will happen with the country if it doesn't go our way. It's funny because my mom, I will talk to her about our work and then she'll start yelling about Trump because she saw something on TV and I'm like, I can't focus on it. I'm going to focus on my work. Because I can change all of these structural issues that make it easier for these moms to run. And then I can endorse them and fund them. And then once they're in office, I can work with them to pass really great policy. That's what I can focus on. That's where I can make a difference. That's what I can do. Because you see, once these moms get into office, they immediately start passing critical legislation that supports women and families and children and focusing on education and healthcare and Medicaid reimbursement for doula coverage. Samer Brook and Michaela Salaj has worked on that in New York, and they're just amazing moms that we've supported. And if you can focus on that, that's what I do. That's how I run Vote Mama. I try to raise as much money as possible to make as much change as possible.
I don't know if you've run across Hopium Chronicles, which is Simon Rosenberg. He's been a long time professional Democrat and thought leader, and he has a Substack. He was one of the people who thought that we would do well in 2022, where everyone was talking red wave. And he's also been underlining what the strengths are in the Democratic Party and in Biden's presidency. And sometimes it's a little bit of an antidote to all of the teeth gnashing. Of course, we're all worried because it would be such a catastrophe if we get Mr. Trump back. But
yes, yes, it would. But the more we can do down ballot, the more we can
everything work. Matters. And the fight continues no matter what, right? No matter which way it goes. It's not, it doesn't end. We still got to try to improve our country.
That is the goal.
When you look around at other people who you admire that are also in this fight, who comes to mind?
Glenda Carr from Higher Heights, I think, is incredible. Erin Velarde from Vote Run Lead is just amazing. They're both doing really important work. People like Katie Bethel, who actually serves on our board now, she founded Paid Leave for the U.S. and built an entire campaign strategy around trying to pass paid family leave. Some of our moms who are in office who are just absolutely incredible. I love Jen McClellan. I love Nakima Williams. I love Hillary Scolton, Katie Porter. Just watching these women step up and say, screw it, I've got kids. I don't have time for this. I'm going to pass good policy. I'm going to talk about these issues. I'm going to talk about them from a really personal way and talk about how these policies affect me at a visceral level. I love those badass women. I ran in 2018 and I feel like it was the first cycle that we saw moms talk about motherhood more. One of my favorite photos is Abigail Spanberger giving her acceptance speech with her three-year-old between her legs. Yeah. And I had done so many of those during the campaign. And it was just, it was women who said, you know what, enough is enough. We're going to fix this. Amy McGrath's videos, when she first came out, she was so exciting to listen to her talk about policy as well.
A friend of mine was Assistant Secretary of State under Obama. And I went to the ceremony where she was installed, John Kerry and stuff. And she had a kid up on stage with her. And I thought, this country is changing. All of these little things are moments in a long passage forward.
Do you remember there was a huge video went viral? Gavin Newsom's two-year-old went up on stage when he was speaking and everyone was just like, oh my God, he's this amazing dad. But still, like, yes, this country is changing, but not as quickly as we would.
Well, people see that through many different eyes. I'm sure that a lot of people see a dad with a kid differently than a mom with a kid, which is probably what you're getting at.
Moms hold kids and they're immediately criticized. Dads hold a kid and he's the best dad ever.
I think I would see it as a positive thing in either case, but yeah. But I'm a sucker for parenthood.
There you go. I mean, I love that Eric Swalwell always has his kids with him. You know, anytime you talk to Eric, he's driving to a doctor's appointment with the kids in the back and he's always bringing the kids. We need to see more of that. That's how you start to normalize it. There's a dad's caucus now in Congress. It's huge. Yeah. I love it.
So what has it meant to you to turn your life into politics as you have?
Everything. I love it. Politics is incredibly personal to me. I don't know if you saw Nikki Haley literally gave her speech at New Hampshire yesterday. And she's like, to so many people, politics is personal. It's not personal to me. And I remember just yelling at the television, politics is so personal.
And also, I don't buy it. I don't buy it. I think she's, you know, the layers that she's working through, I can't even imagine, you know, like all the self-editing. And I mean, she's a very skillful politician in her way, but she's also extremely constrained by the party she's working in, the candidate she's against. I don't envy her that role at all. I guess we all have to go our own road.
That's true. But I remember watching that being like, I so very much disagree with you because politics is very personal to me. I have three little kids. I'm raising them in this country. I worry every day I drop them off at school that something, knock wood, will happen. I have air tags on them. It's something that's always in the back of my mind. To be able to do this work and to actually have it be my career
Therapeutic.
It's so therapeutic because there are so many parents who are just so pissed off and don't know where to start. And I was able to channel my pissed offness into freaking change and to be able to teach other people how to do that and to get involved. And there are so many moms who have stepped up to run because they saw other moms do it. I remember a whole bunch of women from Long Island decided to run for local seats after my congressional to see that and to be like, well, you did it with a kid. I'm going to do it.
It's contagious.
It is contagious.
Yeah.
And we have so many of our moms now that we supported for school board races or city council races are running for Congress now and running for state ledge seats. That's everything. Because the more we see that, I mean, we released this report looking at, we call it the politics of parenthood, and looking at the data of how many moms are serving in these state seats. And then you look at the correlation between paid family leave and where we've lost abortion access. We don't have enough moms in those seats. Alabama has absolutely no moms of minor children serving in their state legislature. So we have to change this little by little. By the time we're 45, 85% of American women are moms. And yet less than 7% of our Congress members are moms of minor children. What does that tell you? We're missing a huge perspective at the decision-making table. So to be able to do this, you know, I come up, I have my little attic office up here and I drop my son off at nursery school. My kids go on the bus. I come up here and I sit down at my desk and I can't believe it's my job every day because I love the work.
I love when someone finds that for themselves. And I think that is a lot, not for everybody, but for a good number of people that is going out and picking a thing to do and making it happen. It's exciting to me to see you doing that and other people doing that. One thing I'm curious about in this age of social media and new ways of communicating, how do you reach out to the world? Where would people find information out about you? What platforms, et cetera?
We're on plenty of platforms. There are too many, in my opinion now, but we're focusing mostly on Instagram. So people can go to Vote Mama Lobby on Instagram and follow us there. Our Vote Mama Foundation is on Twitter. Vote Mama PAC is on Twitter. You can find us at Vote Mama on Facebook, but at Vote Mama Lobby is where we're really trying to build the biggest following to give people, you know, the candidates to support and the actions that they can do and how they can get involved in our legislative work. It's hard, you know, with everything that just happened with Twitter. I will never call it X. I can't do it. And there are all these different platforms. But most of the people that we're trying to reach, the millennial moms, they exist on Twitter. So Vote Mama Lobby on Instagram.
If someone, having heard this, would like to help Vote Mama, what should they do?
They should follow us, first of all, at Vote Mama Lobby on Instagram, and then go to votemama.org. When you go to votemama.org, you'll see our foundation, our lobby, and our PAC, and you can click through. We're accepting applications right now for 2024 candidates. So if you go to votemamapac.org, you can fill out your endorsement application if you're running. Please send that to any mom that you know who is running, any Democratic mom, and really follow us on Instagram for more ways that you can get involved.
Well, thanks so much for your time. Anything else you want to say?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing I can say is if you want to make a difference in politics, if you want to change who runs for office, you have to start thinking about all of the structural things that hold people back and really start talking about them, because there are a lot of people who don't find that sexy. That's not the interesting thing to talk about, but really that's how we change things. Campaign funds for childcare, it's a small structural change, but it has the ability to completely transform the political landscape. If you look at our federal funds, more than 60% of the funds spent by women were spent by women of color. More than 70% at the state level that were spent by women were spent by women of color. This is a resource that helps more moms run for office, more caregivers, and particularly moms of color. Makes a huge difference. So start to talk about these issues. There are a lot of people who, even if you can actually use campaign funds for childcare in your state, are still afraid to, just because they're afraid they're going to be politically attacked. The more we can talk about it and the more we can normalize what it looks like to be a working class person running, the better off we'll be. Because right now we have more men named John in the Senate than moms of minor children. There are more millionaires in Congress than moms of minors. It has to change. We need people who actually have that lived experience, because all legislators legislate on their lived experience. So talk about the structural issues, talk about the hardships when you're running so that other people can understand what it's like, and support really great badass mama candidates. Come to votemama.org and get involved in all of our work.
Thank you so much. That was Luba Gretchen Shirley. She is at votemama.org. This is Nathaniel G. Perlman with the Great Battlefield Podcast. You can find us at greatbattlefield.com or by searching for Great Battlefield in places where podcasts are found. The Great Battlefield is now part of the Democracy Group Podcast Network. Visit democracygroup.org to learn more about other podcasts that cover democracy and civic engagement. You can also help me by leaving comments and good ratings on Apple Podcasts or elsewhere, and by sending me suggestions for great guests to nperlman@gmail.com.